down when they reached the farthest tree. He leaned against the trunk, throwing one khaki-clad leg over the other. He had rolled up his shirt sleeves, and Amisha saw the hair on his forearms glistening. She sank down on the grass, confident he would follow.
"It's the celebration of the new year. Dias light up every home."
Small flames in clay lamps were continuously refilled with oil so they could burn for 24 hours.
"For 9 days, we dance."
Amisha's favorite was the first day, when people offered sweets and flowers to the gods and goddesses.
"We begin with Navratri and end with Diwali."
Her voice rose with excitement.
"Fireworks light up the sky. Mango leaves and flowers cover doors and windows."
Amisha picked up a fully bloomed flower that had fallen. She inhaled its scent before passing it to Stephen. He took it and did the same.
"We exchange gifts and sweets with our loved ones and then pray for spiritual growth and strength."
"Strength for what?" His face showed genuine interest. Amisha considered all the reasons she prayed. Nima and her story of sacrifice came to mind.
"To have the strength to accept all that life offers, good and bad."
Stephen glanced at the sky, and then his gaze fell back on Amisha. She saw him swallow deeply and wondered if he was thinking of his brother. He finally asked,
"Whom do you pray to?"
It wasn't the question she was expecting.
"Lord Ganesh and his parents."
Ganesh was the remover of all obstacles. The fact that she was here, learning from Stephen, showed that her reverence had paid off.
"The elephant god?" Stephen asked.
"Yes." Impressed that he knew, Amisha explained,
"He's the son of Lord Shiva. Do you know the story?"
Stephen nodded, surprising Amisha.
"His father cut off his head by accident, then replaced it with the head of the first animal he came across. As an apology, he granted his son the power to remove all of life's obstacles," Amisha finished,
"and with it, provide the path to enlightenment."
"Maybe I should convert."
Amisha's head shot up, but she saw the teasing look in his eyes.
"Are you searching for enlightenment, Lieutenant?"
She nudged him with her elbow, but then immediately regretted her forwardness. Embarrassed, she folded her hands in her lap.
"Some would say I need to."
His smile helped to ease her shame. Seeming restless, he stood and started to pace in the garden.
"The temple in the village would welcome you."
She started to say it didn't discriminate, but then thinking of Ravi and Bina, she bit back her words.
"A member of the Raj in the temple?"
Stephen shook his head slightly.
"I think this garden is where my enlightenment will begin and end."
Amisha didn't know how to respond, and both fell silent. Finally, she said,
"The celebration also honors the goddesses."
Amisha waited while Stephen retook his seat at an acceptable distance from her beneath the shade of the tree.
"The three most powerful goddesses, the goddess of power and strength, of wealth, and the goddess of knowledge and learning. 9 days of dancing, 3 days each to honor each of them."
With a small stick, she drew the letters of the English alphabet in the dirt.
"Is there a celebration for goddesses in England?"
He leaned back on his forearms.
"There are no goddesses to be found in the Bible or elsewhere."
"No goddesses?" Amisha was shocked.
"Then who are the gods with?"
"With?
As in sleeping with?"
Heat rose over Amisha's neck and onto her cheeks. Stephen's eyes danced with amusement as he watched her.
"God doesn't sleep with anyone, as far as we know," Stephen said, and there is only one God. No multiples.
Oh, Amisha said, silenced by the information.
You seem surprised.
He glanced at his watch. Classes wouldn't let out for another hour.
Were you taught about other religions in school?
At the mention of school, Amisha shifted away from his probing gaze.
I was pulled out after 6 years to help with the household duties.
6. Stephen calculated the time.
You were 11.
Yes, Amisha answered. She could imagine what he was thinking. She was an uneducated village girl, and he was part of the powerful Raj. He had to be wondering why he was wasting his time with her. Suddenly, she was self-conscious, and her previous exhilaration disappeared. She searched for an excuse so he could leave. Sure, he would want one.
You must have work to do. I have taken up too much of your time with my ramblings.
She was about to stand up when Stephen's hand fluttered over hers. Only for a moment, making her wonder if she had imagined it. It wasn't long enough to attract anyone's attention. Not the attention of the gods to whom Amisha prayed, nor the attention of any wandering eyes of the school staff. But long enough to remind her who he was. A man who cared enough to teach her.
I'm sorry. That must have destroyed you, Stephen said quietly.
It wasn't so bad. Amisha spoke past the lump of gratitude in her throat.
I stole my brother's books in secret and read them.
She paused, remembering that time.
Soon after, I began to write.
A person with your abilities should have the world at her feet. Overwhelmed by his words, Amisha stood abruptly to hide the emotions that threatened. She motioned for him to follow with a wave of her arm.
I'm going to teach you the Navratri dance, she said.
Oh, no.
He followed her, but crossed his arms over his chest.
My nanny tried to teach me to dance.
His stance left no room for argument.
I don't dance.
Amisha searched the ground for small branches. She handed two to him and then wandered around until she found two more.
Everyone dances.
Dancing was a means of celebrating every major occasion, marriages, holidays, etc. For Amisha, it was the time when men and women came together without thought or concern of gender roles. Though she had never seen the British join in their festivities, she had started to view Stephen, in their garden, as his own person.
You teach me English, so I will teach you to dance.
You want to learn English, Stephen griped.
I don't want to learn to dance.
Amisha ignored his complaints. She took the jagged point of his stick and positioned him. Taking her place across from him, she held up one stick in each hand and signaled for him to do the same.
Follow my lead.
When he didn't immediately comply, she waved her sticks until, with a deep sigh, he followed suit.
Satisfied? He asked.
Yes. Amisha bit back her laughter at the sight of him holding two branches of leaves.
Now, move one stick forward and hit mine, like this.
Amisha demonstrated and then followed with her other stick.
Good,
she said.
Notice my ability to compliment.
Because I am able to hit your stick with mine, I'll be sure to return the favor when I teach you to play with pieces of wood, Stephen said dryly.
Amisha ignored him.
Now, we do this 5 times, and on the final hit, you turn in a full circle and move to the next person in the circle. See?
Amisha twirled around in her sari. Her hair flew around her as her sari loosened. Her foot caught in the hem, and she stumbled forward.
Whoa!
He reached out just as she was about to fall.
He caught her beneath her arms, his fingers resting against the side of her breasts as he studied her.
Are you all right?
Yes, Amisha murmured. Thank you. His warm breath graced her cheek. Embarrassed, she stepped out of his arms. The warmth his touch elicited warred against the expectations ingrained within her.
I'm sorry. I became overexcited.
No apologies necessary, he assured her. He waited until she met his gaze to say, Maybe it is important I learn the steps of your dance.
21. Today, we will write our first full story in English. Amisha handed each student a booklet after writing the assignment on the board in simple English. Last night, Amisha had helped Jay for the first time with his English homework. Afterward, he climbed into her lap and thanked her. She had swallowed the lump in her throat and hugged him back before tickling him. When he ran off laughing, she glanced at the makeshift temple and nodded her thanks. Now, using her limited artistic skills, she drew a picture of the earth and colored the ocean blue and the land green. Who can tell me where we come from? The assignment had come to Amisha after she and Ravi had a discussion with the boys about karma and the universe's determination of their place. Jay had asked, in his innocence, what crime Ravi had committed in his previous life to be born an untouchable in this one. Amisha started to scold, but Ravi assured her it was fine, and yet neither had the answer as to why one was born into his station in life.
God, one student answered. Evolution, we come from apes, another answered.
And how do we live our life? Amisha saw their confusion and tried to explain.
Once we are born, are we still controlled by the person or event that made us? Are we puppets?
The students shook their heads no.
Then how do we make our decisions?
Our hearts?
Nima's answer was tentative, sounding more like a question. Amisha nodded her approval, offering encouragement.
Our gut, a boy in the front added. What feels right?
Our soul,
Amisha asked the boy.
At his nod, she said,
Excellent, all of you.
Amisha made sure the class was focused before continuing.
The heart and soul work on emotions. They don't stop to think about what is right or wrong, only what they want and need. So, where do they get their direction?
From the brain.
The answer came from the back of the room.
Correct. Our minds guide us toward what is acceptable for us to create, protect, or destroy.
And where does the brain get its intellect?
Amisha searched the room for an answer. At first, the class was quiet, the children glancing at one another to see if anyone had the answer. Finally, a student near the front answered,
From what we learn or have been taught. By knowledge?
Excellent. But even with our brains, heart, and soul guiding us, can we do anything we want? Do we have the freedom to make our own choices?
When the class murmured no, she asked, Why not?
Our parents, a student threw out, making everyone laugh.
The Raj! A girl in the front whispered.
Rules, Nima said. Thrilled that the students were interested, Amisha said,
I want all of you to write about creating something you want, destroying something you don't need, and protecting what is vital. But you must explain how your heart, your soul, and your mind feel about each event.
Amisha was cleaning up the classroom when Stephen walked in. He glanced at the board. The earth?
The glasswork.
Amisha started to erase the picture. Wait. Stephen barely touched her hand as it held the eraser, but she immediately stepped back. He quickly read her notes. The heart, the mind, and the soul. Unsure if he approved, Amisha said,
It seemed like a worthwhile topic.
He nodded his agreement, and Amisha felt a small sense of victory.
It is.
He stuck his hands into his khaki pants.
I wish I had such assignments as a child. I would be a much wiser man.
He leaned against the chalkboard and wondered aloud what he would create.
Maybe a really fast car?
He smiled when Amisha rolled her eyes.
You are in a pleasant mood, she noted. It must be the holidays. Christmas in your country, yes?
Yes.
He waited until she gathered her things. In silent agreement, they headed toward the garden. Stephen held the door open for her, and then followed her outside. He grabbed a heavy tree limb and pulled himself up with both arms. My mother is coming to India.
That's wonderful.
Though he rarely spoke about his family, Amisha was sure he must be thrilled. When he gave her a look of unhappiness, she asked,
That's not wonderful?
Shrugging, he grabbed another branch.
My mother is different.
That's not nice.
Amisha softened her words with a smile. She reached up and pulled a leaf off the branch he was hanging from.
She gave birth to you.
Stephen let go of the branch and landed on both feet.
Not by her choice, I believe.
He took a seat on the bench and made room for her. Amisha joined him. Over the last few months, she had become more comfortable sitting in close proximity to Stephen when no one else was around. Without realizing it, they had created their own rules inside the walls of the school. However, every time she was away from Stephen, Amisha worried about her behavior. She would think of Deepak and her marriage, and guilt would creep in. She would promise herself to step back and behave in accordance with society's standards. But then she and Stephen would spend time together. Their interactions were natural and easy, and it was harder to pretend to be indifferent versus being herself with him.
Your mother was not affectionate.
Amisha towed the stones beneath her foot with her sandal. His short laugh was mirthless and empty.
My brother and I were more of an afterthought.
What about your father?
Though she was fascinated, Amisha hesitated to pry. Her desire to learn more about him won out, so she asked,
Are you close?
That depends on your definition, Stephen answered.
His gaze cut to the sky before meeting hers.
It's because of him I am here. He motioned around them. Favors called in from university mates who now run the country.
You're not happy here?
Amisha knew that. He had told her as much when they met, but a part of her had hoped he was enjoying their sessions as much as she was.
I'm not unhappy.
He caught her gaze and held it before breaking away to glance over her head. His mind elsewhere, he murmured,
It's just that there's a war going on, and my mates are fighting in it.
Why aren't you?
He began to pace in front of her. His Adam's apple bobbed when he swallowed deep.
I told you my brother died.
He waited for her to nod before continuing.
He died fighting. He was in the Royal Air Force. After that, I was assigned to India rather than the front lines. My father found the safest yet most respectable job he could for me.
Tears pricked the back of her eyelids.
Your brother was older?
Only by 20 months.
He laughed at himself before admitting,
I always wanted to be him while hating him at the same time. Once he was lost in his memories, his shoulders relaxed and his face softened. He used to play these crazy pranks on me every single time he got me. You loved him. It wasn't a question, but Stephen answered it nonetheless.
I did. Still do, he corrected.
He kicked a pebble and watched it bounce into a bush.
Guess it doesn't end with death.
He took a deep breath before saying, I don't know if I ever told him. Shaking his head, he said, Now it's too late. Amisha wanted to comfort him, to tell him that in time it would get better, but she had no idea whether it would. So instead, she listened and hurt for him silently.
Your father? Is he doing all right?
I don't know, Stephen said quietly. Whenever I call home, he's not there for me to ask.
But he must be a good person, Amisha said, sure of it.
Why do you say that? Stephen watched her carefully.
Because you are such a good man, Amisha said.
When his gaze held hers, she refused to look away. Whereas before she had felt uncomfortable and nervous, there was now an ease and familiarity.
If he had a choice, I wouldn't be here.
He lowered his voice before admitting,
My father thought living with the Browns was the lesser of the two evils.
Amisha flinched at the derogatory term used so frequently by the British. Flustered, she asked, Is that what you believe? She hoped for his answer, but feared it at the same time. If he admitted to her that he shared his father's views, then she wondered how they could continue their lessons.
My brother traveled frequently before the war.
Inside the building, the classes were letting out. The sound of children talking and walking through the halls spilled from the closed door into the garden. Stephen paused and listened until the halls were quiet again before continuing.
India was, of course, on his itinerary. When he returned, he told me it was different here, and that it was frightening to a few. But the same blood runs in every human on the earth. You just have to see past the variations in skin and culture.
Relieved, Amisha nodded.
He sounds like a wise man.
Then he punched me in the stomach, as brothers do, and told me I wasn't brave or man enough to ever leave home. Amisha saw his grief as he relived the memory. Called me a mum's boy. Amisha heard his pain and grieved for him.
Are you?
He shuddered at the thought.
Bloody no. Mum and I aren't close.
He assessed Amisha before saying,
She mostly keeps to herself. Exact opposite of you, I'm sure.
It was the last thing Amisha expected to hear. He pushed his foot against her mound of pebbles.
I bet your children always know what is on your mind.
Worry, Amisha said immediately. I pray they don't kill themselves with their antics.
Your boys know how much you love them, Stephen argued. There is nothing you would not do for them.
I would not be a good mother if they ever questioned my love and loyalty. Amisha refused to sacrifice her time with them, so she waited to practice her words and check classwork until after they were in bed. That left many nights when she watched the sunrise as she finished her studies.
Therein lies the difference between my mother and you, Stephen said. You care what they know and think.
Unsure how to respond to the compliment, Amisha asked,
What will you do while she is here?
He considered her question. Taj Mahal, New Delhi, Bombay.
A British tour, then? Amisha teased.
Where would you recommend instead?
Amisha pulled a lone flower off a bush and offered it to Stephen.
Take her to Kashmir, maybe Mount Abu.
Mount Abu?
A treacherous winding road cut into the curves of a mountain.
Amisha used her hands to demonstrate.
The road leads to a peak where a magnificent temple sits carved from marble.
Her family had traveled there for a wedding. She still remembered her wonder at the sight.
Or the Dal in Srinagar. It's a majestic lake surrounded by flowers that would make the one you are holding seem modest in comparison.
She smiled, warmed by the memory.
Go on, Stephen encouraged quietly.
Kashmir is the grandest of all.
Amisha had heard members of the Raj and their wives using Kashmir as their personal retreat and playground.
Heaven on earth, Lieutenant. Mountains surround open valleys, a painter's dream, lush green forests, and a landscape that would make you weep.
Amisha remembered her one visit there. Barely able to afford the trip, her family had slept on a friend's floor. Nearby, music spilled out of the doors of an opulent British hotel.
Even as the sun warms the petals of the flowers, snow caps the slopes in the distance, Amisha said. But none of it compares to the people.
She remembered those who lived there, opening both their houseboats and hearts to guests. Stephen listened quietly as she reminisced.
It's breathtaking.
Amisha would have loved to return, but the travel cost was extravagant, and Deepak couldn't take the time away from business.
While there, my father said to me that beauty in such true form must be rare, for only then do humans appreciate it.
Amisha had been 6 when her father planned the trip for the family. Equal admirers of the splendor that surrounded them, she and her father had stood next to each other on the banks of the lake. Lost in the beauty of the region, they stared at the mountains that served as a backdrop to the fields of flowers.
Take her there, Lieutenant, and show your mother the natural beauty that can compete with the magnificence of your castles in England.
It was the first time Amisha had told anyone about the trip that meant so much to her, the only recollection she had of spending time with her father during her childhood. Like many men, he was busy with work and Amisha's brothers, leaving her to her mother. Stephen, his hand moving of its own accord, reached out to grasp a strand of hair caught on her lower lip. He waited, a breath of a second, his eyes meeting her, before sliding it between his fingers and then tucking it behind her ear. Amisha closed her eyes as his fingers brushed against her earlobe, lingering against her soft skin and the gold hoop of her earring. She nearly cried at the simple yet intimate act. Her pulse increased as guilt weighed on her for not turning her head. She convinced herself that to Stephen it meant nothing, and yet, for her, it was a violation of everything she had been taught as right and wrong. Regardless of the dictates, she couldn't move away.
Your father is right, Stephen said softly. It is so rare to see such beauty.
22. Amisha and Ravi were sweeping the front porch when a group of soldiers walked by. Though they were dressed in civilian clothes, the familiar small baton was strapped to each of their hips.
Is something bothering you, Srimati?
Ravi asked, continuing to sweep.
Why do you ask?
Amisha returned absently as she stopped to watch the men.
You seem unhappy, Ravi answered.
Amisha turned toward him with a raised eyebrow.
You are concerned with my happiness?
Ravi shrugged and continued to sweep.
Usually not, but since you are increasing my workload, I find myself suddenly unhappy.
Ravi had gathered a small pile of debris with his broom. Amisha, in her absent-mindedness, had swept most of it all over the porch again.
Therefore, I will worry about yours, if only to improve my own situation.
Amisha eyed the scattered debris and cringed.
Sorry.
She leaned against her broom.
I was thinking of the lieutenant, she admitted. When does he return?
Ravi asked.
Soon.
Amisha didn't know the exact date. Though she imagined the teachers at school knew, she hesitated to ask them. On the surface, they had accepted her teaching at the school, but made no overtures to welcome her.
What makes the lieutenant different from them?
Ravi gestured toward the officers. They were watching a group of children play cricket. When one of the children made a challenging hit, they joined the team in clapping and cheering.
I don't know how to describe it,
Amisha struggled to explain.
When we are in the garden, I can speak to him as I wish.
He treated her as an equal. With him, she felt safe to be herself and, in doing so, started to discover who she was.
I find myself happy, she said, not sure if she had known what that meant before.
Ravi listened without interrupting. When he saw the smile on her face, he returned it.
His absence must be difficult for you.
You say that without judgment, she said carefully.
You have been telling stories since before I met you.
He paused before saying softly,
I know you have never been able to share them.
With Deepak was what he didn't say.
I was judged for wanting more than I was allowed, ridiculed and berated. You were the only one who understood and accepted. Who am I if I stand in judgment of you now?
Amisha swallowed her lump of gratitude.
Thank you.
She reined in her emotions and thought of a story to help better explain her feelings, both to herself and Ravi.
Shall I tell you about the king and the prince? Since you have doubled my duties, it would be an excellent time to entertain me.
Ravi reached for Amisha's broom, and she happily handed it over. She settled into a chair and thought through the tale.
A king ruled his land with an iron hand and strict rules, as his ancestors had.
She paused, waiting for the next part to come to her.
The king had only one son, the prince. When the prince inherited the throne, he remembered his father's advice to rule as he had.
Across the way, one of the officers joined the children's cricket game. The children's squeals of laughter interrupted the story. Amisha and Ravi both watched silently, neither voicing their thoughts.
But the prince was blind, and his tongue was deformed, so his speech was often garbled.
Amisha started again.
He wondered how he could rule with his handicaps.
She closed her eyes and imagined the prince and his heartache. The demand on him to be someone he wasn't. He admitted his fears to his close friend. His friend said, "Go to the people. When you can't see them, touch them. Instead of speaking your orders to them, listen and hear what your people have to say."
A wise friend?
Ravi set his broom aside to hear the rest of the story.
So, the prince did as he suggested. He hugged the children. When he did, he felt bones where their flesh should be.
When he held the women's faces, his hands came away wet from their tears. They were hungry and poor. Amisha choked up as the words flowed from her. The father's words were filled with sorrow. They wanted better lives for their children, school and music, sticks of color so the children could draw pictures, poetry books to fall asleep with each night. Riveted, Ravi asked, "What did the prince do?" "He chose not to rule like the previous kings. Because of his friend, the prince ruled with his heart, and his handicaps became his strength." Amisha thought of her own place in life and the handicaps she carried with her. "And because of this, his people loved him." Unsettled, she glanced into the house and then back toward the game that was breaking up. Finally, she admitted, "The lieutenant makes me believe I have worth, regardless of who or what I am." When she was with him, she believed herself to be intelligent and worthy. Because of the opportunity he gave her, she imagined anything was possible. "When he is gone, I wonder if that belief is an illusion." Seeming to understand, Ravi nodded. "For you, I hope he returns soon." The students fidgeted in their seats as they waited. Nima had volunteered to read her story first, but for the last 5 minutes, she had stood in place, staring at the words. Her fingers gripped the thin paper so tight, Amisha wondered if it would tear. "Betty," Amisha said gently. When Nima barely turned her head to glance at Amisha, she asked, "Would you like to start reading your story?"
"Yes, madam."
Her voice shaking, Nima began to read aloud her story, crafted for the assignment.
"A young girl, recently married, walked alongside her husband to return home. He used a cane while her young legs itched to dance. But there was no music, only the steady beat of the cane as she kept pace with him. One day and one night had passed since her marriage. When night fell, the girl sought out the shelter of the moon. She fell to her knees, her tears watering the ground that was his. There was a flash of light, and she saw her life before and the one now. But when she searched her future, the picture was empty. 'Guide me to be who I want,' she asked, but there was only silence. She searched for her own strength and became her own counsel. 'I want to explore the world,' she whispered. She looked to the stars and the sky and imagined a world other than hers. To a greater power, she gave thanks for having created her. Then she laid her hand over her heart and asked it silently what it desired. 'To be happy,' the girl heard. She then laid her hand over her abdomen and whispered the same question. 'To be free,' she heard. The girl raised her face to the moon, its rays the only light in the darkness. She set the pad of her fingers over her forehead and listened to the beat of her blood for the answer that lay dormant. There was another flash of light, and she nodded her head. She knew now what she needed to do to protect what was vital. She bade goodbye to the house in which she had been sentenced to spend the rest of her life. With each step toward autonomy, her heart felt lighter and her soul more confident. At the edge of the cliff, she stared over the ledge. The embrace of the abyss called to her, and her final step took her to freedom. 'Nima,'
Amisha had waited for the class to empty out. Other students had read their stories aloud after Nima. Some took on world events, such as hunger and the war, while others chose themes closer to their hearts. One boy wrote about evil versus good, with warring monsters, but none elicited the shock and questions that Nima's did.
"Your story was powerful."
"Thank you," she said quietly.
Nima scooped up the pencils with the erasers chewed down and stuffed them into her bag.
"You're a very gifted writer."
Amisha trod carefully and thought through her next words.
"Do you enjoy school?"
The girl stared at the empty classroom around them.
"My betrothed invites many of the British military into his home."
Nima fidgeted with her diamond studs. Either she had not heard Amisha or was purposely ignoring her.
"He wants me to be able to entertain them without sounding dull. An English education assures that."
"What do you want?" Amisha reached out for the girl's hand, but Nima jerked it away. Amisha was scared by the story, unsure whether it was a warning or a young girl's overactive imagination.
"It doesn't matter."
Nima hunched her shoulders and curled her hands into fists.
"How do you dream when your destiny has already been determined?"
She grabbed her schoolbooks and opened the door.
"Nima!"
Amisha called out, trying to stop her. But it was pointless. Nima had already left. Jaya. 23. My father worked hard to build up his own thriving medical practice. Ever since I was young, it was assumed I would join him and then take over. My future as a doctor was firmly established before I fully understood what it entailed. As I grew up, I found I was less interested in medicine and more in words. When college came and it was time to decide my major, I revealed my choice of journalism to my parents. I braced myself for my father's disappointment, but was surprised when he said he understood. Grateful, I started to leave the table when my mother spoke up.
"Medicine has been decided," she said.
"No," I said, refusing to acquiesce. "I'm going to be a reporter."
"Jaya,
it's my life," I said before she could say more. "It's my right to do what makes me happy."
"Happiness cannot be assumed," she corrected. "You will be a doctor."
My father asked me to leave the room so he could speak to her alone. Close to 30 minutes later, they came out and told me they supported my decision. I thanked my father and left without a word to my mother. She never said another word about that day or my decision. In the mornings, Ravi and I tour the village, and in the evening, he tells me the story while we eat. Tonight, Ravi and I dine at the Punjabi restaurant. Unlike the spicy sautéed vegetable dishes that Ravi has been preparing for me, the Punjabi entrees are steeped in heavy cream and butter. I devour the rice pilaf mixed with vegetables. Everyone is so gracious and welcoming. I wave to a group of children who hover nearby.
"You have made their day."
Ravi wipes his plate clean with his naan.
"We are not used to foreigners."
"Foreigners, we have many,"
the restaurant owner says as he refills our glasses with mango lassi. Age lines cover his worn face and hands. He's paired his loose white cotton pants with a short-sleeved button-down shirt. His skin is nearly as dark as his hair.
"It's rare to have a guest of Ravi Sahib."
"His particular charm doesn't attract hordes of people,"
I give Ravi a teasing glance.
He's too busy caring for the departed Saab's house and his other properties.
The owner sets down a plate filled with dessert.
He hires people to tend the garden and the mill. The mill has been unused for many years, but not even a spider dares to enter for fear of its life.
You pay for the caretaking? From our daily time together, I know he doesn't have an income source.
But there's no one left to pay you. Your family paid me a king's ransom when I worked for them, he says, as if that is reason enough.
He finishes his sweet in two bites and then dips his napkin in the water glass to clean his hands.
It is my responsibility to care for what is theirs as they cared for me.
The owner bows his head in respect toward Ravi. To me, he says,
in their death, he is still your family's trusted servant. Your mother should be proud.
You knew my mother? Since my arrival, no one has mentioned her name. It is as if she never existed. His gaze collides with Ravi's, and a silent message seems to pass between the two.
Only by sight.
He's evasive, clearly hiding something.
You look exactly like her.
He nods to both of us before leaving. Why doesn't anyone know my mom? I ask after the owner leaves. She grew up here, yet she's a stranger. Instead of answering, he picks up a piece of halva and hands it to me. Flies that have been wandering in and out of the open-walled restaurant land on our table in search of the sweet smell. I swat at them with my folded napkin, but only succeed in bringing them closer.
She kept to herself, he says. She rarely went out when she was growing up.
Not even to visit the garden? I ask, wondering how she could have kept away.
She did not know its significance.
As so often happens, when he is telling the story, his eyes are haunted and his words measured.
Your grandfather closed the school after your grandmother's death. Much of the garden died in the years in between.
There's a flicker of sadness before he rubs his hand over his face.
Only after his second wife's death did he allow me back in.
You brought it back to full bloom. His silence gives me my answer. He would have had to tend every flower, every bush, with love. I wonder what my grandmother did to deserve such loyalty.
I did not know he owned the school. How did that come about?
He shakes his head. And I know it will be the same answer, that the story will reveal its secrets soon enough. Since we have met, I have learned that pushing him will accomplish nothing.
Were you this stubborn when my grandmother was alive?
When he smiles, I ask,
with my grandfather's death, who owns the school now? Your mother.
Shocked, I stare at him.
Your uncles relinquished their interest in the house and mill. Your grandfather left the school to your mother to do with what she wishes. He said it belonged to her.
Does my mother know this? She never mentioned it before my trip or during our call.
I don't know.
He shakes his head slowly, his fatigue apparent.
The property office says its letters remain unanswered.
His shoulders slouch downward in defeat.
If the properties are not claimed within 60 days of Deepak's death, the government will sell them to the highest bidder.
He swallows.
Your grandmother's memories, her legacy, will be lost forever.
I stand on the porch
and stare into the darkened night. A full moon shines in the starlit sky, a view I'd rarely seen under Manhattan's city lights. After dinner, Ravi returned home, but I am too wound up to sleep. I process Ravi's revelation as I walk among the unadorned walls. I run my hand over the various pieces of furniture, imagining the time when my grandparents and mother made this house their home. In the story, Amisha's love for her home and family is obvious. Why then would her children refuse what was hers? I think of my own home, empty now. It was easier to walk away than I would have imagined. When we first moved in, Patrick and I spent hours decorating the expensive space that validated us and our careers. We arranged and rearranged every piece of art and furniture until it was perfectly placed. It seemed it could only be the perfect home if everything was absolutely right, and at the time, that was so important to us. Only when I yearned for the hands of a child to wreak havoc did I realize it is not the decor or the address that make a home, but the people occupying it. I grab my computer and rest it on my lap. I skim my hands over the keyboard, feeling the calm that only the written word brings me. Too tired to censor what I say, I start to type. I started my career as a reporter on the business beat. It suited my need for figures to support the facts, but after becoming jaded enough not to believe everything I heard, I was promoted to sports. I had never been a fan, so imagine both my surprise and horror at hearing stats recited verbatim by men in locker rooms who believed I was equally invested in how fast a cut fastball was thrown this time versus the last 20. After 6 months, I begged for a transfer to the technology section. My editor offered me literature instead. Books are a conundrum of sorts. Though I value words above all else, stories were never a lure. But I opened my mind and came to appreciate that even in fiction, there can be morsels of truth. Imagine my fascination at learning that my grandmother, a woman who died before I was born, yearned to write tales. Hope was her life raft that one day they would be valued. Hope is a four-letter word and one of the simplest in the English language. Contrast that with floxonosonai hilipilification, one of the most complicated. Hope. For such a simple word, its meaning is profound. The intellect in me dismisses its claim, while the writer never understood the appeal of the intangible. Yet, it was the only thing my grandmother and so many others like her held on to. My grandmother wished to write her stories in English, a language that was foreign to her. To me, the granddaughter who has had only the best in life, it seems like such a simple dream. I chose to write as my career. If I deem something important, I put the words on paper. They are safer to me than speaking words aloud. Never once, when putting pen to paper, have I feared the consequence of following my vocation. It never occurred to me to ask permission or wonder if I was allowed to be more than others wanted. In my life, I take my dreams for granted. No matter what they are, I assume they are possible. It is sobering to learn of a woman one generation removed who lived a life I can't imagine or understand. I am mortified by my naivete and ashamed to admit that my bubble became so dark that I only saw my own shadow. In hindsight,
I think we all protect ourselves from that which is too difficult to know. But that excuse is just that. My grandmother's pain seems incomprehensible, while her strength inspires me. In comparison, I am weak. For all the beliefs I had of my own strength, it is humbling to know I am severely lacking. As a citizen of the world and as a woman, I can only strive to do better. What that means is still a mystery, but I'll take my first step of this journey in anticipation of where it leads. Along the way, I may learn a thing or two. Maybe there's hope for me after all. Finished. I start to hit send, but then again hesitate. The pain of the last few years became a secret well kept. When I needed Patrick, I didn't turn to him, but instead kept my own counsel and let him keep his. It was easy to be together in the moments we were strong, but it felt impossible when I was weak. Now, tired of hiding, I reread the blog entry and then hit send. Before I can question my decision, I shut off the computer and go to bed. 24. I run a fine-tooth comb through my hair to check for lice. For the last few days, I haven't been able to stop scratching, and Ravi mentioned I may have been infected. I scrape the comb's teeth against my scalp and spot a small brown bug. I pick it out with a toothpick before repeating the procedure. Another one, and then two more by the time I'm finally finished. Disgusting, I mutter.
Something specific, or just an observation?
Ravi asks, finding me on the back porch. When he spots the small comb, he nods in understanding.
Have our little friends welcomed you to India?
Calling them friends may be your first problem. Unamused, I point to my head. Any advice on how to get rid of them?
I'll bring you a chamomile paste later. It suffocates them.
Looking forward to it. I pull my hair back and quickly braid it. I showered early and threw on a long sundress. Ravi and I made plans yesterday to explore some of the other towns. When he told me he had been out of the village only a handful of times, I insisted we tour together. Inside the house, there's a knock on the main door. I glance at Ravi.
Are you expecting anyone? I have no friends, Ravi says simply.
Yes, that's why we're stopped repeatedly in town, with people wanting to say hello. I roll my eyes before opening the door. On the porch, a young girl, no older than 8, fidgets in place. 2 braids fall over her shoulders, and her short dress with puffed sleeves reaches right above her scraped knees. Gold-colored sandals grace her feet, with a flat ring adorning her toe. Plastic bangles line both of her tanned arms.
Hi.
Surprised, I glance back at Ravi, who shrugs, telling me he doesn't know what this visit is about.
Can I help you?
Jaya, Srimati?
Yes, I'm Jaya. You are? I ask her inside, but she gestures for me to follow her.
There is a call for you, Srimati, at my father's store.
She jumps off the porch and lands on her feet.
Please, come quickly. The connection will be lost.
I'll wait for you here, Ravi says when I glance at him.
Keeping pace with her rapid gait, I ask, who is it?
A man from another country. My father spoke to him.
It has to be my father. Worried, I move faster. How did you know who I was?
It is well known.
Shy, she barely glances at me.
You are from the American States?
The United States? Smiling at her enthusiasm, I say, yes, I am.
The store has never received a call from the American States.
With a maturity that seems to surpass her age, she says,
The lines are not very good. Let us go.